Welcome to Where I Come From, a new podcast dedicated to Nebraska sports figures and the life experiences that shaped them. I'm your host, Dirk Chatlin, and this week's guest is John Cook, three-time national champion volleyball coach at the University of Nebraska. We talked about his childhood in San Diego, his passion for football, his unlikely introduction to volleyball, the day in Lake Tahoe that he nearly died, and why his job is harder than it used to be.
I always kid all of our athletes, they all wear Chuck Taylors. I'm like, you guys are nerds. I wore that when I was in junior high. And I remember my first pair was $2. I literally laid in bed for 9 weeks. I could not leave the bed. This generation has no tools how to deal with failure. And this is the number one issue that causes all the challenges of coaching this generation.
This is Where I Come From. You became head coach here in 2000, but the first time you came here was 1988 as an assistant to Terry Pettit. What do you remember about seeing Nebraska for the first time?
I just remember flying into a very small airport thinking, wow, this is really tiny. And then I really don't remember much about the visit or going around, but the two things I do remember are going to Barry's for dinner and meeting sports writers, because all those guys hung out there and Pettit was buddies with them, and then staying at the Cornhusker. And I thought it was the nicest, grandest hotel I'd ever stayed in. And what really made it special was there was a basket with a card saying "Welcome to Nebraska," you know, and a goodies basket with snacks and stuff. So
it was a recruiting spiel for you.
Exactly, but I was so impressed by that, and I thought the Cornhusker, I mean, it was the nicest hotel I'd ever stayed in.
What do you you'd met Pettit? I mean, this all happened pretty quickly, right? Because Pettit, you didn't exactly go way back together.
No, so we met in March of 88 when he brought the Nebraska team out to San Diego, and I had a club team that was really good, and there was a couple other college teams, so we all scrimmaged each other at University of California, San Diego, in their gym, and of course I met Pettit, and so they were running a rotation defense at the time. I'd never seen that before, so I started asking questions about it, and so we talked for a while, and that was it. I went home, and he went and played golf, and they were out there for the whole week, but I was, you know, teaching school. So, in May, I get a call from him saying, "Hey, would you be interested? I have a coaching opening. Would you be interested in it?" And I'm like, I don't know. I even thought about going into college. And so,
because you're at that point, you're running like a really successful high school program, right?
Yeah. So I'm teaching school at the time at Francis Parker,
which is a small private school.
Yeah. I'm coaching girls volleyball, girls basketball, and middle school boys basketball, which is in the spring. I'm running a PE program with all kinds of intramural sports. I'm getting my master's and running a club program. And
so you're swimming in it.
I'm going all out every day, like full 12-hour days.
And married at that point,
yeah,
right?
And my wife's working for Price Waterhouse, and she was grinding, and we had just bought our first house, right? Like, I think we had just moved in. In the beginning of 1988, and so we had saved for basically 6 years to get a down payment to move into a house. So we just moved in this house. And I remember, what happened was, so I came out on the interview, went back, and I wasn't sure we really wanted to leave San Diego. All of our family's there.
You'd never lived anywhere else.
No. And so Pettit actually flew back out. And I remember because we had just moved in this house. So he actually flew out to recruit or do something or play golf, probably is what he did. And he came to my house and came and sold the deal and closed the deal. Because my wife had never met Pettit. So she had no idea about Nebraska. So we were hemming and hawing. So it wasn't like I came here and like, okay, I'm taking the job. He actually flew back out and met Wendy. And
so Wendy came. Wendy agreed sight unseen.
Sight unseen. And so the story goes, so we agreed to it. And then so we loaded up a U-Haul pickup truck. I had a Toyota pickup, and we put a U-Haul trailer on the back. And we drove out here, and it was August 5th, and I'll never forget this in that. So we drove from San Diego, and so we drove, got up really early and drove and got all the way to Ogallala. And, of course, it's night at like 10 o'clock at night, and I remember we pulled into the whatever the hotel. There was one hotel in Ogallala. So we pull in there. The wind's blowing from the south. It's at night. It's over 100 degrees, and, of course, the feedlot, you can smell the feedlot because the wind's blowing from the south. We walk in the hotel. There's cockroaches in the hotel room, and Wendy just has a meltdown and says, "We are turning around and going home." And I'm like, "Wendy, Lincoln is a lot nicer than this. I've never been here. You know, I can't even pronounce this town, Ogallala. Just bear with me, you know." And so the next morning, we got up and drove into Lincoln, and of course, we've now look at ourselves as Huskers.
Your only exposure to Nebraska at that point was basically Tom Osborne.
Correct. And so as a kid, I knew about Nebraska. I remember seeing the helmet with Ann on the helmet and watching Coach Osborne coach. And of course, the Nebraska-Oklahoma rivalry, I was really into that. And because Barry Switzer, you know, that program got a lot of attention at the time. But what really intrigued me was I couldn't figure out when I was a kid watching all this why a doctor was coaching football, you know, and how is a doctor, you know, a medical doctor coaching a football team? And so it just all, that's the one thing I remember on how intrigued me, like, this guy's a doctor and he's coaching football. So I continued to watch, and of course, eventually I figured out he was a doctor of education, not a medical doctor. And I don't know, I just got hooked on Nebraska. But that was my only, you know, connection to Nebraska, was the Nebraska football.
You grew up on a lemon ranch in basically right outside San Diego, right?
Yeah. So I grew up in Chula Vista. I was born there. Chula Vista is 7 miles from the Mexican border. It's about 20 miles south of San Diego. And my great-grandmother had moved from Chicago in 1911 because of her husband's health reasons. So they had to move to a climate because he got scarlet fever. And so I think it affected his lungs. So they had to move out there so it'd be easier on him the weather-wise. And, of course, San Diego has almost perfect weather. So she started a lemon ranch, and Chula Vista in the 20s and 30s was the lemon capital of the world. And so she had 100 acres that she homesteaded and developed this lemon ranch and was selling lemons. And eventually when World War II started, that all shut down because they started taking land from her to build homes for people to work in the aircraft factory because they were building planes for World War II. So all that shut down, and you know, and she actually has a elementary school named after her, Cook Elementary.
Really?
Yeah, and the reason is part of it was what I just told you, and the other part was during the Depression, so in the 30s, her and another woman started making huge buckets of soup, and they put it on a Model A pickup truck. And ironically, I learned how to drive on a Model A pickup truck.
Really?
Yeah, because she still had a Model A pickup truck on this ranch, and it was they took a Model A and converted it into a pickup to haul stuff around the ranch. And so she would go around to the schools and feed the kids. So it was really the first hot lunch program, you know, in schools, at least in the West Coast. And she and another woman started it. And so actually it was President Nixon had to do a presidential deal to name this school, and we have a thing from him, you know, talking about her service, and she ended up being in education for 50 years.
Wow. And, so you grew up doing farm stuff, though.
Yeah. So I was raising, we'd raised cucumbers, tomatoes, lemons, tangerines, oranges, avocados, and I would go around as a kid and with my wagon and walk around the neighborhood and sell them to the neighbors. And that was, you know, of course, in San Diego, you can pretty much grow stuff year-round. So that was a way to start making money to buy motorcycles and my first car and my first pair of Chuck Taylor Converse. You know, I always kid all of our athletes. They all wear Chuck Taylors. I'm like, you guys are nerds. I wore that when I was in junior high. And I remember my first pair was $2. Black Chuck Taylor Converse low tops. And that's what we wore. And now kids wear them for fashion. And that was the shoe we wore to play basketball in.
Your parents had you in some pretty tough circumstances, right? Your dad was 18, your mom was 17, and he went and worked in an airplane factory?
He actually had some skills working on cars and dune buggies and motorcycles, and he raced. So he was very mechanical, and they needed what was called heliarc welders at the aircraft factory. So he became a heliarc welder, and it's a very clean way. It's like almost welding in a surgical room, but it's how they make airplane parts and tanks and parts of airplanes. It's all really clean welding, and I think it's done through electricity. But so he was doing that, and then by then the Lemon Ranch was down to about 9 acres, and so it was enough for us to ride our motorcycles and our bikes and run our dune buggies around and have a few, you know, a big huge garden that we had. And by then we weren't really selling lemons or anything like that.
How did you get into athletics?
So what happened was, we would do the pickup stuff and, you know, watch the Chargers or watch the Packers and you know, go pretend football and then go to the rec center and community center and play basketball. But really, you know, you really didn't get exposed to sports till you got to ninth grade. And so, and I remember in junior high, they had a basketball team. Of course, I went to a junior high school. There was probably 1,500 kids in the junior high school.
Oh, wow.
Of course, I got cut from the basketball team. And so once I got to ninth grade, I got into sports in the high school. And anyway, started doing pretty good and really liked football. And then I would talk to the football coaches. I'd be out there, how do I do extra, you know, and we weren't even lifting weights back then. I mean, there was a kind of a weight room, but it's like, if you wanted to go there, I mean, it wasn't a stress that much at all. And so anyway, through high school sports, I started playing and, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to be a coach was because some coaches took me under their wings and really helped me. And I remember, you know, drawing plays up in class and handing it to the coaches. And so...
Did they run any of them?
I think so. I it was always fun to create. And I don't remember specifically, but I think there was some pretty good dialogue going on. Because I remember sitting in their... I'd go in their offices and we'd be talking football. So it was... You know, I must have had a knack for it and a strong interest, and they really embraced that. But so one of them said, "Hey, you ought to go play in college." And I'm like, "Well, I don't know how. How do I do that? I mean, nobody in my family had gone to college. I mean, it wasn't even discussed. I mean, it was never
really
even mentioned. No, I was going to graduate from high school and either go be a welder or work construction, or I mean, that's where I was headed.
Huh.
And this coach said, "Hey, I think you could play." And so ironically, I said, "Okay, how do I do it?" He says, "Well, you got to take the SAT test." So I took it, flunked the verbal part of it. And I'm like, "Okay, I'm done now. I can't go." And then my English teacher said, "Hey, we can get you so you can pass that." And so I actually enrolled in 2 English classes, and she tutored me. And eventually my senior year, in the spring of my senior year, I finally passed the verbal part along with the math and was eligible and ended up getting a scholarship to Linfield College. And I wish I would have played football, but I got more money to play basketball, so I took the money part. And ironically, Linfield College, people say, "Where the heck's that?" It's up in McMinnville, Oregon. And one of the greatest NAIA college football coaches, Ad Rutschman, was coaching there, along with Ted Wilson, who was the basketball coach. And I lasted a year because I couldn't take the rain and no sun, and ended up getting hurt and wanted to come back to San Diego State where I could do rehab, because they just started an athletic training program there. It was the first in the country. And Coach Riley came in the year after I left and started coaching with Ad
Rutschman. So you left in about 76 or something like that?
Yeah, it was
and then he would have got there right after
that. Yeah. And then eventually Danny Langsdorf shows up and plays football there. So, and was a quarterback. So, small world, and but legendary coaches there. It was a legendary NAIA.
Yeah, Rutschman coached baseball too.
Yeah, they had to do everything, and they taught.
Yeah, Riley told stories about how he'd have to go, you know, he'd go sit out in the bleachers in March and, you know, watch baseball games or coach baseball games, and his wife would be sitting in the bleachers keeping score. And yeah. A pretty small existence at that point.
Yeah. So in hindsight, I wish I would have stayed there, but, you know, I wasn't mature enough to handle being away and, of course, getting hurt. And there was they had no athletic trainers or anything. So I wanted to come back and rehab to get healthy again. And then I ended up transferring to University of San Diego.
How did you get into volleyball?
Okay, so
I mean, there's, you know, your football, basketball. I mean, this is all the traditional stuff. And
yeah. So at University of San Diego, so my sophomore year I played basketball, and then my brother came there. He was 2 years behind me, and he was really good, top recruit, and he ended up coming to San Diego as well. So we actually played together our junior year. But it was Division II at the time, and they were going to Division I, and Jim Bervelli was the coach, and Jim Bervelli is also a legendary guy because he played on the University of San Francisco team with Bill Russell when they dominated and won NCAA championships. And so he was the coach, and he said, "Hey, John," and I was a forward and my brother was a guard, and my brother was averaging like 25 points a game, and I was, you know, I was a rebounder, you know, enforcer,
right?
And he said, "We're going Division One. You're too small and I don't see you playing." And I said, "Hey, I got the writing on the wall." Well, ironically, my dad had left the welding industry and gone to work for a company called Stanley Andrews Sporting Goods. And he actually was a rep to the Chargers, San Diego State, University of San Diego, and the high schools, selling them their uniforms and their balls and their equipment.
And to the Chargers, too.
Yeah, yeah. And so I got to go down and watch Charger practices, and it was really cool. So, anyway, our junior year, we actually moved down to Mission Beach, which is, it's 10 minutes from University of San Diego, but it's right where SeaWorld is, and there's a really cool beach there. So we thought, hey, this would be a cool place to live. So my brother, myself, and then two other brothers, Hank and John Ashworth, all got an apartment down at the beach. And there was these guys who were teachers who would come get off school every day at 3 o'clock and come out there and play beach volleyball right outside our apartment. So we're like watching these guys, like, what's this? You know, and up until this point, we didn't know anything about beach volleyball or volleyball, indoor volleyball, nothing. So we're watching these guys, like, this looks pretty cool. So we'd go out there and start talking to them and, you know, how do you do this? And they would show us. And so we started playing, and then we just became addicted. And same thing as like going to the gym. You get up, you challenge on a court. If you win, you stay. If you lose, you sit. So the first summer, we were losing all these old guys. These guys were out of shape because they just knew the wind and the shots, and they knew how to play, and we didn't. You know, and they were these, you know, basketball players, and we'd get so frustrated. And so I would actually, and this is kind of probably where my coaching really first started, I would create drills for me and my brother,
really,
to work on beach volleyball. Because you couldn't go get a coach, you know, you had to teach yourself. So just like basketball, we taught ourselves. Football, you know, we taught ourselves till we got to high school. So I would create drills in the sand that we would work on to get better. Well, by the second summer, we were starting to win and beat everybody. And so that's when I'm like, hey, this is really cool. And then ironically, that second summer, which would have been my senior year, at the end of my senior year in college, I was playing in a mixed doubles tournament at La Jolla, and I actually played against Wendy, and she was playing with a guy, and I was playing with a girl, and we crushed them. And for whatever reason, I went up to her and I said, "Hey, I'd like to ask you out. But I don't have any money right now, so I can't take you out tonight, but can I get your phone number and call you?" Because I was a total starving college student.
Right.
I had a Volkswagen that the floorboards were rotten out. And
at least you're not still driving the Model A.
Yeah. So anyway, I asked her out. Well, I soon discovered she played at San Diego State and was an All-American volleyball player. So then I'm like, oh, okay, what's this indoor game? So I would go and watch her play that fall. And I actually started coaching football that fall too. And so that's, we started dating and blah, blah, blah. And anyway, that's where I kind of got into indoor volleyball. And then to actually get my first coaching job. So we got married a couple years later. And I was coaching football, but I was trying to get a full-time teaching job.
Because you weren't teaching at the time?
You couldn't get a teaching job. They were so hard to get. So what you do is you substitute teach. So that's where I started at Coronado High School. So I would substitute teach and then coach football. Well, you don't get benefits. You don't get any of that. So when we got married, I had to get a full-time teaching job. So the school calls me, and I'd actually done some of my student teaching there. It was right up the street from University of San Diego. And they said, hey, we got a teaching job for you. It's geography. You're going to coach all these girls' sports, girls' volleyball, girls' basketball, girls' softball, girls' track, because girls' sports were just starting.
Right.
So all of a sudden, they need all these coaches. And I said, well, I got to have a full-time teaching job. I said, now we'll give you a full-time teaching job. We're going to give you an apartment on campus.
Really?
Because it was a private school. And they converted some buildings to apartments for teachers, because how do you afford to live in San Diego,
right,
you know, on a teacher's salary? So they were really progressive. So we got an apartment for $125 a month right on campus. And that's where we saved for, you know, 6 years to get a down payment to buy a house, because interest rates then were 14%. So it's just like a whole nother era compared to what everybody's used to now. And so they said, we need you to coach girls volleyball. And I said, well, I have no idea how to coach girls volleyball. I can coach girls basketball. I'll figure out softball, and I'll figure out track.
You had to coach all four.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and again, and girls sports were just getting started. So the girls had no clue either. So I actually went to some clinics, and I found a club coach up in Orange County that would let me come and watch his practices. And so I just, and then I coached them like football. And these girls are crying every day. And I'm literally, the principal is calling me in like once a week, like, you can't make these girls cry. And I'm like, I'm just coaching them. You know, they cry. You know, so it was just really awkward. But what happened was we started winning. And we were starting to like crush teams. Because eventually these girls kind of got tough, and they got into it. And they, once they got success, like, okay, this is pretty cool. And
you were good at it.
I was just coaching like football, but it was just drill the crap out of them, fundamentals, and, you know, and we're not going to make mistakes, run them if they make mistakes. I mean, it's so old. It was just like football. So anyway, we our first year, we go to the state tournament. Like, nobody in San Diego was even going to the state tournament, and we go to the state tournament. And it was all dominated by LA schools and San Francisco schools, because they had club programs, and nobody in San Diego had a club program. And that's why eventually I started a club program that's how I met Pettit. And the club program, when I started, the first year we had over 200 kids in 1 year.
Really?
It just exploded. I mean, we ran out of uniforms. We didn't have gyms. I mean, it was a disaster from a business point of view, because it was so big, we couldn't manage it. So
you eventually became the first San Diego school to win a volleyball state championship, right?
Right. So that at Francis Parker, we started going to state, and of course we'd go up there and get smoked. And then eventually, so that was in 1982, and in 1985, I think we won our first state championship, and it was the first school in San Diego to win a state championship in any sport, and especially volleyball.
Wow.
So, and then we won three in a row. So it was, we had it going. And that's, and actually that was 86, 87. And then I left to come to Nebraska in 88. And my assistant took over, and she won it again in 88. So 85, we got to the finals. That's what happened. We got the finals and lost. So we became this powerhouse in San Diego at this small school.
So you're getting job offers?
No, there was no job offers. I mean, I was perfectly happy having summers off, coaching my team, teaching school. I mean, and Wendy was at Price Waterhouse. I mean, we had finally got a house. We were set. We had no, we weren't looking, nothing. I started on my master's because I wanted to. San Diego State started a master's program in teaching and coaching effectiveness. And I was at a private school, and most of the teachers had their doctorate or their master's. Hmm. And so I was, and I remember sitting with the principal. He was actually called the headmaster. And I said, well, why did you hire me here? Because I'm not, and because this is a college prep school. I mean, these kids are going to Stanford, to Cal, to MIT, and of course, others, nobody's going to Nebraska, you know, because it's out of sight, out of mind. But they're going to UCLA, USC. I mean, these are, you know, high-level kids academically. And I'm like, he goes, I hired you because you're a great role model, but, you know, it would be good for you to work on your education. So I found this program at San Diego State, Masters of Teaching and Coaching Effectiveness, and it was actually run by a guy named Dr. Brent Rushall, who was a world-renowned sports psychologist / physiologist, and he was one of the first ones to do study of sport. He was Australian, so he did all the Australian swimming. Then Indiana hired him to run the Indiana swimming program, and if you remember, if you go back, Indiana dominated college swimming for years. Hmm. And there was a guy in there named Doc Councilman, I think was his name. He's a legendary swim coach. So he was running, by then he was retired from all this, and he was doing he had been doing the Olympics, and he was just teaching in San Diego kind of on his retirement out of all this. And he was an unbelievable mind for all that. It was a great master's program. I got straight A's. I just ate up every second of it.
So your fascination, because I think one of your characteristics as a coach now is sort of your obsession with the mental part of all this. It started then, huh?
Yes, and now that master's program is called sports psychology. But back then there was, you know, psychology was, that's where the people are screwed up. You know, they go to see a psychologist. Sports psychology, he was the first one, cutting edge stuff that he was doing.
What was he teaching?
It was all about modifying behavior, what motivates athletes. And so he had books of surveys, and I would survey my club team and my high school teams, and we would figure out what motivates them, you know, how to deal with failure, all those things. I mean, he was studying all this. Of course, he was using me and my research as part of his research. But there was also the, you know, how do you plan a year out? I mean, a whole year. How do you have training cycles? You know, so it was cutting edge at the time. And so we were looking at from a scientific point of view, from a mental point of view, and also a team building point of view. So all those things were factored into these classes and the research we were doing.
How much of that stuff are you still kind of falling back on?
I don't go back to that stuff more, but, you know, there's new people doing it now. And, you know, we've got people here. Brett Haskell's really good. Dr. Wibben's really good. And these guys are Michael Gravey, who's Kayla, you know, has worked with him. And, I've listened to his podcast and studied him. And he works with the Seahawks, so I've studied Pete Carroll. So you're just doing the same thing. It's just advanced and more fit for this generation.
Do you think that stuff, I mean, obviously the physical training is, you can't go anywhere without that. But, I mean, when you're at the level that you're at, that's kind of that's the difference, right? I mean, that's the mental stuff is the difference between really doing it and just kind of succeeding.
I think all those things, you know, you're trying to be, there's a fine line between being good and great. And, you know, you're trying to get over that line. But I was really lucky to be with guys like Rushall. And ironically, so when I came to Nebraska as an assistant, so I was here 88, 89, and 90. And then I left right after the Final Four, and I got hired by the USA Men, which were based in San Diego. And when I went to that program, they did not have a strength coach, so I had to create the whole strength program for these guys and the whole men's program. Well, right away I got Rushall. I went to the Chargers where I had a connection with Phil Tine, who was a strength coach there. And there was a guy I met and ran into through the golf business, because if you remember, I told you there was Ashworth Brothers and the Cook Brothers. And my brother, after he was done playing professionally in Australia, He joined with the Ashworth brothers, and they started the Ashworth Golf Company.
Ashworth, is that Ashworth?
That is the Ashworth.
Really?
So those guys went in the golf industry. I went into coaching. And so my brothers worked for Ashworth, and now it's bought by Adidas. So technically now he works for Adidas. And those guys all went into golf business, and I went into coaching. But through the golf business, I met a guy named Pete Egoscue, who is a genius in working with the human body. And he actually, his claim to fame was Jack Nicklaus was trying to get ready for his tournament and his back was hurt. And they said, hey, Pete, come in. And this is a whole other podcast I could talk about Pete Egoscue. But he fixed Jack Nicklaus, and all of a sudden he was a guru. Well, Harlan Savari was coaching the Chargers at the time, in a time frame in there. And he actually left the Chargers or got fired and went to work for Pete Egoscue, working with pro athletes. So all this kind of formed here, and I got to be a part of that. And so I tapped into these guys, Phil Tine and Pete Egoscue and Brent Rushall, and we created this program for the USA men. And from a health perspective, a mental perspective, a training cycle perspective, because these guys were, we had guys that were 21 years old and we had guys that were 35 years old. So we had to create this really customized program, and it was awesome.
Sports science.
And so we ended up getting a bronze medal, and we were two swings away from a gold medal. And so it was just a great experience. And so I've had a very strong interest in all of that. And it's really paid off, because when I went to Wisconsin after the Olympics, we had no strength coach at Wisconsin. When I came here, Boyd would give us a football GA. There was no female strength coaches. So I actually did our strength training when I first came back to Nebraska as a head coach. And then eventually I recruited Laura Pilikowski to be a strength coach. And then, of course, she took it over, in about couple years after she had finished in 2004-2005.
You and Osborne are kindred spirits on this stuff. Did you ever sit down and pick each other's brains or talk to each other?
Well, so this is the, the kid in me. So I would purposely, when I was an assistant here, so 88-89-90, I knew when Coach Osborne, he would always come in and lift a run after practice, his football practice. Well, we would practice kind of at the same time. So I would go in the weight room, and the weight room now is where the academic center is. So I would go in there when he would lift and talk to him.
You'd stalk him.
I totally stalked him. But I'm like, this is Coach Osborne. And he, you know Coach Osborne. He would talk to me. So I would talk to him. I would ask him questions. And I was really fascinated by how they trained with the four stations. So they'd have four offensive groups going, four defensive groups going. So I'd watch that, and I would ask them how they would do that and so on, and the reps. And that's how I coach volleyball. I mean, we're very efficient. We get as many reps as we can. We break down, and we try to, make it as efficient as we can.
Fundamental and repetitious.
No question. So that's where I really learned about coaching, studying them and him, and I would stalk him. And ironically, when I went to Wisconsin, Coach Alvarez, who went, and he was just turning that program around when I was there. And I can remember I was driving back from Chicago, and they won a big game. And I had to pull over. I was crying, because it was just like it were their first big win, And I think that got them to the Rose Bowl or something. But I would actually, at noon, lift, and then those Alvarez would always sauna every day. So I started going in the sauna with Coach Alvarez and talking. And so ironically, when he comes back to Lincoln, which he does at least once a year, he always comes and finds me and says hi. So it's pretty cool.
In the midst of all this, a little bit earlier, you almost died. You're 1980, you're 24 years old, you're hiking in Tahoe. What happened that day?
Well, we had gone up to, so my brother and his girlfriend and Wendy and I were not married at the time, but we went up to Lake Tahoe to play in a mixed volleyball tournament. So we drove our Volkswagen up there, and we couldn't afford a hotel. so we camped. So we're camping out and we plan this volleyball tournament, 2-day, 3-day volleyball tournament. And so we decide it's on a Tuesday. So I think it was a 3-day volleyball tournament. It ended Monday. And I think my brother won it. And I think I finished second or third. He won. He played with Wendy, actually.
Oh, really?
And I played with another girl. And I think they won it. So we got some money and some dinners. And we went out that night and had dinner at a really nice restaurant. And so the next day, before we drove back to San Diego, and this is Tahoe's probably a 10-hour drive. So we decided, hey, we saw this waterfall way back up in the mountains, and we said, hey, let's hike up there. That looks really, this huge waterfall. You can see it from the road around Lake Tahoe. You can just see it way up in the mountains. So we had breakfast, packed up, drove up to this lake called Cascade Lake, and you had to hike like an hour around this lake up to these falls. And it's in what's called Desolation Wilderness. And so it's a hiking area, but it's not like, you know, families go. It's called Desolation Wilderness for a reason. So we hike up there, and then it's just beautiful. We're like, hey, let's just keep going. So we go to the top of the falls, and then we keep going into Desolation Wilderness. And we hike all day, but we didn't have anything with us. No water, no food, no nothing. So it's about 6 o'clock at night, and we're coming back down. And we get to the top of this Cascade Falls. And anyway, we decided to take a break there. And so there's some big boulders up there. So we decided to roll a couple off. And anyway, I'm pulling on this one. And I just was pulling, like exerting energy to try to get this thing to roll off the top. And I stood up and basically passed out and went off.
Wow.
So... anyway, there's
like off a cliff.
It was a 100-foot cliff, and it was a waterfall. So I actually ended up down in some rocks and some bushes at the bottom, and I was wearing a hat, and there was a ledge about halfway down, and the hat actually got, I hit that ledge, and my hat fell off and actually got stuck on that ledge, because about 6 weeks later, I was in the hospital for 9 weeks, and about 6 weeks later, one of my roommates was a rock climber, and he had gotten his knee scoped by Dr. Stedman, who was my doctor. And Dr. Stedman's a world-renowned orthopedic surgeon, maybe the most famous of all time. And he was on call the night I came in. So he was the one that pretty much saved my life, probably. And anyway, my roommate went back up there and got that hat. Wow. 'Cause you had to rock climb. You had to, like, be a rock climber to go up there, and my hat was still up there like 6 weeks later.
How did you survive?
I was in unbelievable shape from playing beach volleyball, and you know, it was you know, I don't know, that's a whole nother
podcast.
How did
they get you down?
Well, so remember I told you had to hike like almost an hour around this Cascade Lake to get there, and so many things just went my way, you know, and I believe there's angels. And so anyway, I was in bad shape, and my brother got down to me first, and he had to get underneath me and hold me up because I was actually hanging upside down off rocks. And of course, I was bleeding on my mouth and I was bleeding on my hip. And I told him, I said, okay, I think I dislocated my hip and I think I knocked some tooth loose.
So you were conscious?
Yeah. And he said I was calling for him. And so what happened was my jaw was broken in a couple of places, and I had a compound fracture of my femur. But I didn't know it because I couldn't see it. Of course, he got there, and he's like, you know, trying not to throw up. And so he has to get underneath me and hold me because I can't breathe because I'm choking on blood because I'm literally upside down. So he gets underneath me, and I lay my upper body on top of his thighs, and he kind of sits in the hillside and forms like a little platform for me to lay on. So I tell him what's wrong. And so Wendy and his girlfriend are up there, and they're, of course, they're freaking out. And they're calling my name, like thinking I'm going to get climbed back up to the top of this thing. Like, and I'm not. And so as they're calling my name, a guy named John is coming down out of West Desolation Wilderness. So he's coming down to the top of the falls. And he says, hey, I'm over here. So they actually think I crawled back up and was okay. But it's a different John. And he happens to be a respiratory therapist that works at the hospital in Lake Tahoe.
Oh my gosh.
So he gets down to me, he stabilizes me, builds a fire, because this is now it's getting dark. And he sends Wendy to start running out, because I'm still laying on my brother. So my brother has to stay there because they don't want to move me, because they all know what's going on. I don't know.
And what's going on means what?
Well, I'm losing blood, and so his girlfriend and him were putting pressure on where I compounded my femur, and trying to keep me from bleeding. And of course, my mouth at that point, I had to be up so I could breathe. But I didn't. I just thought my hip was dislocated. I didn't know I had a compound fracture.
Got bones sticking.
Yeah.
I mean, it's.
Yeah, my femur was out. So.
trying to imagine him being your brother.
Yeah. So he's a stud. And he was there for almost over 3 hours. He had to hold me up. And of course, he starts cramping. And every time he's cramping and moves me, you know, I'm screaming because it's so painful. So Wendy takes off, and as she's running out to the highway, which is literally an hour hike, but she's running, and there's a guy fishing in the boat in the lake, and he happens to be a sheriff, and he's off duty, but he has a radio. So he calls the rescue team. It takes him 3 hours to get to me, but by him being there, probably saved an hour. And so they get the rescue guys up, and of course, as soon as he finds out, so he gets the rescue guys called. He parks his boat and he walks up to where we are, and so he's there. So I got a sheriff, a physical, a respiratory guy, and so they're just talking to me and, you know, doing all that. And by the time the rescue guys get there, there's like 24 of them that get up there, because they have to put me in a leader basket and carry me down because it was still really steep. And, you know, we're in a waterfall area, so it's rocks and steep. So they got to carry me down and hand me down.
And it's pitch dark.
Pitch black. But, you know, they got flashlights now, and we had a fire going. So he gets me down to the boat, and it's a 14-foot little aluminum boat. And they put me in the boat. And I remember this guy in my face like, okay, you cannot fall asleep. You got to stay awake. And, of course, they're talking to the hospital on the radios, and they can't give me any pain medicine because they don't know what's happened to my head, so they won't give you pain medicine. The doctors won't, because if you've had a brain injury or something, it can really mess you up. So he puts me in the boat, and I remember him. He'd been drinking whiskey, and I can remember, like right now, I can smell his breath, you know, whiskey breath. And he says, you know, if this boat tips over, you're going to the bottom. So, and he's pitch black, and he's got to navigate out through these rocks across this lake to where the ambulance is waiting. So we do it. He gets me the ambulance and takes me in, and Dr. Stedman's on call. And you know,
you got there like what?
This is like probably 2 or 3 in the morning. And Stedman happens to be on call. So
what did Stedman do?
Well, he told me that he says your jaw's broken. So he says there's nothing we can do about that right now. And he says you got a compound fracture of your femur. And he says, we have to clean it out because if it gets infected, it could kill you. So they brought in 4 nurses and they held me down. They still have no pain medicine. And he takes literally a hose. And I'm looking at this thing, and he takes this into where the wound is, and he has to start flushing it out. And he goes, this is really going to hurt. And at some point I passed out. It was so painful, and I just remember waking up the next morning, and they were able to start giving me pain stuff the next morning, but it was so painful. They were holding me down, and I passed out. And so what he did, though, he put me in traction, and he, some other incredible things happened that, you know, I don't know if we have time in this podcast, but, you know, the great thing about Dr. Stedman was he actually played football at Alabama for Bear Bryant.
Really?
And he was right after the Junction Boys. So we talked football every day. He's a great guy, but he knew I was a football coach. And because at the time I was coaching football.
Yeah, you were coaching at Coronado.
Yeah. And so we talked football every day. And then he had a guy named Pete Patterson come in, who was a U.S. ski team racer, and he had gone through the same thing, because what happened was, he said, I'm going to leave you in traction because you're healing up great. He says, I don't want to pin this. I don't want to operate.
What is traction?
So basically, he put a pin through my shin bone, and they drilled like the old crank drills. They drilled a hole through, put a pin through it, and then had a string or a cable with weights pulling my leg into a position. And so I literally laid in bed for 9 weeks. I could not leave the bed. And by pulling all those pieces that broke and pulling my femur back into where it could heal, and after 3 weeks, he x-rayed it and said, hey, this thing's healing really good. We're going to leave you here for another 6 weeks. And, of course, I'm like, I can't do this. And this is where you had Pete Patterson come in, who had just had gone through this a year earlier, and he was coming back getting this final checkup to get released to go ski. And he said, so he got me some dumbbells, and he got me some music, a thing to play music. And he said, here's, you got to work out every day, you got to listen to music, and you got to read. And so he like completely changed my mindset. He says, you can do this, it'll go by fast. And so 9 weeks later, and then I was in a body cast for 3 months. And ironically, I was still living at the beach. And and so what I would do is, my rehab was, I didn't have, there was no rehabilitation people back then. So my rehab, I rehabbed myself, and I started walking in the soft sand. And that's how I started building my strength back up. I was still in a body cast, but I would start in my crutches. I started on my crutches, and eventually he let me start putting pressure on it. Eventually he cut part of it so I could bend my knee. Eventually cut a big chunk off so I could actually move my leg.
Really?
Eventually, 6-9 months later, I started running in the soft sand. So the soft sand was a savior in a rehab.
And, but this took like a year.
Oh yeah, it was a year.
How did that change you?
It made me, well, so he first told me, of course, I had the mindset of, okay, let's heal up and get me out of here so I can get back to playing volleyball and coaching. Well, I had to eventually call my head coach and say, I can't come back. And but I just never thought. And at one point, Dr. Stedman told me, he goes, you know, if I have to operate and pin this, he goes, you'll never play sports again. He said, you may walk with a limp. And once, when he went in traction, he goes, I think this might work for you. And he says, you may come out of this pretty good. And so... And I did. And I went on to play beach volleyball. I went back to playing basketball. I could dunk again. So, I mean, but I pretty much rehabbed myself back and started lifting weights. So, I don't know. It just made me hungry and determined. And, you know, I wanted to be an athlete again. I wanted to coach. So I was very driven to get back. So it taught me about how important mindset is. And I think the other thing, Dirk, and all this that really probably impacted me the most was at some point I was really feeling sorry for myself. But the roommates I had were way worse off. The guys that had been in motorcycle accidents and some guys that came in there, I mean, you know, they lost their leg or, you know, and so I'm thinking, okay, I don't have it that bad. So it just made me realize, you know, no matter how sorry you're feeling for yourself, there's somebody worse off. And you can't feel sorry for yourself. You ain't going to go anywhere. So I just think it was, you know, and I really relied back on a lot of things I learned in sports about mentally tough and pushing through things that helped me get through that. And, of course, being with Dr. Stedman, I mean, the guy played for Bear Bryant. He would, you know, he told me his stories because I would ask him. And, you know, so he had been there, but, you know, what happened, and he was a really good football player, but he decided his calling was to be an orthopedic surgeon and quit after his sophomore year and went into, because he knew he wanted to be a surgeon and wanted to go get into med school.
Whatever happened to him?
He left Tahoe and opened a clinic in Vail, and he's still working in Vail on part-time.
Really?
Yeah. It's called the Stedman Hawkins Clinic in Vail, Colorado. Still, people from all over the world still come in and see him. Pro athletes will go to see him. I don't know if LeBron or I think Michael Jordan went and got worked on by him. I don't know if LeBron has, but he's probably the most famous orthopedic surgeon ever in orthopedic surgery.
Wow. I mean, you were eating food through a straw and
So after a couple of weeks, when my strength built up, they wired my jaw shut and pinned my jaw and where it was broken. And so my mom moved to Lake Tahoe and she got a food processor. They had just come out. So she would make meals and food process them. And all I could eat was what's through my straw, because the hospital, they just had Jell-O and broth. That was it. They didn't even have a food processor. So she rehabbed me back through nutrition, and she would take vitamins and grind them up in there. And so it took me a long time to get it down, but it's just what you can get through the cracks in your teeth. That's it.
Did you ever go back up to the waterfall?
Yep. I went back up there with my brother. Went all the way back to the top. Had to go back up there.
What was that like?
It was sick to my stomach, but it was, I just had to do it. So we went up there, and then once I did it, I haven't been back. But I had to do that as part of, I had to just go back up there. So I think it, I can't remember, it was a year after that or 2 years after that. I mean, it might have been 2 years after it happened.
You know, a lot of people experience, you know, near death in some ways, but that, I mean, that's about as close as it gets.
Yeah, I was very lucky, and so many things happened, you know, that, you know, like I said, I just feel like, you know, sometimes you've got a guardian angel looking out for you, and so many things had to go right. I mean, the chance of Stedman being on call, the guy fishing, a guy named John, who's, you know, works in medicine. It's just, it's crazy. Mm-hmm. But
you proposed not too long after that, huh?
Yeah, it was it was probably 6 months later, yeah.
The Ogallala Hotel doesn't look so bad after that.
Yeah, right.
What did you learn from Pettit? I'm sure you learned a lot, but what stands out still today?
I think Pettit's gift was, I think he really thought outside the box. And he's a dreamer. He's a visionary. He's a very good speaker. He was a very good preparation guy. So he could scout teams and really get a feel for what they're doing. So I really learned a strong aspect about scouting and preparing. He was one of the first guys to have a Macintosh computer. He was doing stuff for volleyball spreadsheets and stuff on, you know, so that was really cool. You know, he's a very high level thinker. So he just made me, he would give me books all the time to, you know, how to think like Leonardo da Vinci, and books I would never, ever go to Barnes and Noble or somewhere and pick out. He says, hey, you need to read this and read this. So he just really got me thinking outside the box and being kind of a dreamer in a way, which I think that was either the thing I took the most from him, and the preparation part, you know, how hard to prepare.
How do you coach preparation without being overbearing? Because, you know, you're dealing with 20, 22 year old girls, women who are got a lot going on in their lives. You know, they're not able to dedicate everything to this. You sort of want to take it off of their plate and yet make it, you know, keep them as prepared as possible. How do you balance that?
Well, for them, we prepare for every match and every week the same. So it's just part of the routine. And so it's just part of ingrained in how we train and how we approach things. But you're right. We can't spend hours and hours watching video. And, you know, Katie and Amber are in Germany right now, and they go, we will never complain about watching video again, because they watch it for 2 hours with their pro team. So we have adjusted our scouting and all that to this generation, which is short attention span, and they are very busy. So we start, we have preparation Monday, preparation on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, game day. You know, so every week is, we're just preparing every day. So it's just part of our training and how we do things. And we may not, let's say we're playing Penn State in 2 weeks. So we might be doing something on Monday practice preparing for Penn State in 2 weeks, but we don't tell them. It's just part of, you know, hey, we got to do this to be really good, and this is what we're going to see, and so we're working on it. So we just kind of package it in a way that it's just part of their routine.
You coached Generation X, and now you're coaching Millennials.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
Man, we that's a two-hour podcast. But, you know, I got Lindsay sitting over here who was that Generation X, and we shake our heads so many times. But, you know, and not only are we recruiting a different or coaching a different generation, our administration is different, you know, in that how we look at things, you know, in regards to punishment and student-athlete welfare and their experience. So you got all that you got to be really conscious of. And we do these student evaluations now where they evaluate us, and, you know, and I have to go meet with our administration about, you know, what they said and what they like and what they don't like. When Lindsay was playing here, that generation, we could care less what they liked. You know, it was about coming in, winning, go hard. And
listen to coach.
Yeah, listen to coach. And we could push them to the hilt, and they would embrace it. And so it is... You know, our this generation works hard, but they don't know how to deal with failure. Lindsay's group could deal with failure. They could deal with in getting punished for it, or deal with failure, or, you know, it doesn't go their way, or sitting the bench or getting beat out. They could deal with it. They would handle it in a way that, hey, I'm going to come back, I'll show you, type thing. This generation has no tools how to deal with failure. And this is the number one issue that causes all the challenges of coaching this generation. They can't deal with failure. They can't deal with that adversity because growing up, they really haven't had to deal with much of it.
So how do you reshape what you do?
I've surrounded myself with a team of people that understand it better than I do. So Brett Haskell, Larry Widman, Jack Riggins, my Navy SEAL guy. I've hired young coaches. Chris is kind of came through that, and so he understands it better than I do. And of course, having Danny was great. And Danny had been there, but she just can relate to them. And now Kayla, who kind of was on the verge of this new generation, and so just surrounding myself with people that will help me understand it and help me manage it in a good way. And I've had to adjust as a coach. I don't want to lower my expectations, but I've really had to think about how I communicate and my tone and how I approach things and how we explain things and market things to our team of what we want to do. You just have to come at it a different way. It's not the old, hey, this is how we're doing it, let's go. You got to convince them why we're doing it, explain to them why they're doing it, why we're doing it, and they got to understand it, and they still might have questions or they might disagree. And
what do you like better? What do you like better about coaching in 2017 than 1987?
Nothing. Nothing.
Really?
No, there's not one thing. I'm old school.
When did you give up on the idea, the dream of coaching football? Because I know, like, even after you got good at coaching volleyball, that was in the back of your mind.
It was
right?
Always in the back of my mind, and I actually, there was days I wanted to go to Coach Osborne and ask him if he'd hire me as a GA and eventually get on staff.
Really?
There's so many days that I thought about that, but so it's still in there, and I've always thought once I'm finished coaching volleyball, I might go back and coach high school football. So, you know, it's just for fun. And because I just think football is such a team game, and it teaches so many great lessons. And it taught me a lot of great lessons. And so, and that's probably one of the things that frustrates me about this generation is getting them to understand the lessons that you can learn. And again, they're so wired into the technology and they're just wired differently, and there's so much they can take from this, and some of them get it and some of them don't, and that's the frustrating part. And I think another frustrating part, like I said, they'll work hard, but I don't think they really appreciate what they have. And so we have to spend a lot of time. I mean, like when Lindsay was playing, if she got a new bag, travel bag, or a new warm up. I mean, they were like, God, this is so cool. Now these guys are like, this is all we get? You know, it's just such a different mindset, you know.
Hey, so, I've got a 6-year-old and he does the same thing when he gets a pair of shoes. I don't know if it's maybe he's growing up in that world too.
Yeah. It's instant gratification. It's I get everything I need, you know, and they're protected. They're so
they're a long way from selling lemons on a ranch.
Right. Right. Most of them, none of our girls have ever had a job, so they've never had to work, and they, you know, they're so structured in club. And, you know, and I call it the reset button. I think another thing that is hard is, so when I played, you lose, you sit. Okay, now they lose, they get to play again. And they go to a tournament. Okay, they lost a tournament. No problem, we get a next tournament. And we get the next tournament. Because they play so much now with club and AAUs. And so, to me, I call it the reset button. It's like playing the video game. Okay, I'm getting blown out. Reset, let's start over. That's what they do. Reset, that's a bad game today. Oh, reset, we got the next game. And where I think in the old days, you know, it was you lose, you sit, you know, you lose and it hurt. And I think kids today are just kind of numb to, you know, failure.
You sound like you don't enjoy it as much.
No, I do enjoy it because it's a challenge. And I just wrote a book
about coaching. Is it done?
Yeah, we're in the final edits right now. It'll come out in fall.
Yeah.
But I wrote a book about it because these guys have taught me a lot about coaching, and this generation has made me a much better coach than when I was, you know, I think, you know, 15 years ago. So they've made me a better coach. I do really enjoy it. It's just, you ask me about what I enjoy more. I like old school, you know, I'm just more wired that way. That's the way I grew up. And but I think our girls enjoy being pushed and challenged and all the things that we do. But it's been a fascinating, it's fascinating to, you know, and working with these other people like Dr. Haskell, you know, how do we get through to these guys? You know, how do we coach them? And so it's been really a fascinating process to learn about coaching this generation, how they're wired.
What have you learned? I mean, the elephant in the room is always what's going on at Memorial Stadium. What you've spent most of your career, I mean, and I want to make sure I point out that you've got the most prominent volleyball program in the country in terms of interest. But have you taken anything from what's happened over there in the last 15 years? I mean, it's really been a fascinating time to observe, you know. I know you pay attention to it.
Yeah, I follow everything they do. I mean, I follow all you guys on Twitter.
Are there
I
read lessons all the articles. That you take from their struggles and their successes?
Yeah, I mean, I'm studying what they're doing. I think the biggest thing I take is how fragile a program is and tradition and all those things. And I coach out of fear of losing that with Nebraska volleyball. So I think it's a great motivator. I don't know if there's specific things. I think there's some things that happened in Nebraska football that, you know, just, you know, stability wise and leadership wise, and some things changed, and, you know, as you're moving through ADs and so on. But it's fragile, and we want to protect it, and nothing is guaranteed. Just because you were good last year or good the last 10 years doesn't mean you're going to be good next year or the year after. And so I just think there's a strong sense of urgency, and each year I go into it, okay, what are we going to do better? How can we notch it up? How can we get these recruits? You know, and I have a 5-year plan that I've given to my administration, I've given to my assistant coaches. This is what we're trying to do the next 5 years. And
you mean tangible goals?
Tangible goals, yeah. And it, of course, we're running. I mean, the sellout streak would be one of them, but we want to protect that. For example, and I just saw San Diego State just lost their sellout streak for basketball. There's it's getting harder and harder to find newer and newer things besides winning championships. But one of my pipe dreams is I'd love to start men's volleyball here.
Really?
Yeah, and there's a big push, and there's a lot of money going behind men's volleyball to get in the Big Ten because they want to see that thing take off in the Big Ten. So they'd love to get Nebraska, Minnesota, Wisconsin. So I'm going to have that meeting with Sean at some point. I've got a proposal ready to go that some very prominent people have put together, and there's a lot of positives to it, and it's a very low-cost sport. But only three schools have won national championship in women's volleyball that did not have men's volleyball: Nebraska, Washington, and Texas.
Really?
Think about that. But, you know, softball has baseball. Track has men's and women's. Football, you know, technically, I don't know if women's soccer could pair there, but football's up. Basketball has men's and women's basketball. I'd love to see a male volleyball program to go with our women's program. I think the fans would love it. I think the two programs would feed off each other. It would enhance our athletic department, and I think we could be successful.
Do you have an interest in administration at some point?
I've thought about it. I've had a lot of people mention it to me, but I don't know. I might be too much of a wild card. So
if Tom Osborne can do it.
Yeah, and he did a phenomenal job here. I mean, he reinvented this place when it really needed it. And so I don't know. But I like coaching right now. I mean, I was worried after this year how fired up I would be to get going and you know, losing some great players but I don't know, I can't wait to get back until we start in the gym.
Really?
In April, yeah.
That's gotta be hard to stay driven, isn't it?
I don't know. I keep thinking, you know, at some point, when am I gonna not feel that? But I feel like we got something to prove this year. You know, last year it was the hardest years are when you're expected to win it.
Yeah.
And it really there's not much joy in it, because if you like, we don't win it and everybody's okay, well, you know, great season, but you know, wish you could have gone two more matches. Well, we won the Big Ten. That might have been one of the best accomplishments ever. How tough the Big Ten was, but people forget that right away. But that was a hell of a championship to win. But we didn't win the national championship, so it's like a failure. Well, next year we're not going to be picked to win it. Nobody's even expect us to go to the Final Four, you know, and it's just going to be kind of a rebuilding year. So now there's like the chips back on the shoulder, man. There's something to prove, and that's what I think has got me really fired up.
Thanks for listening to Where I Come From. You can subscribe on iTunes or Google Play, or check us out on omaha.com/podcasts. Thanks to Bird Creek for the music. If you have ideas for guests, please email me at dirk.chatelain@owh.com.